Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. And that's a Black Crowes song that's only timely once a year. It's called Good Friday. And today in the Christian calendar is Good Friday. It also aligns with Passover in the Jewish world. So if you have a faith, cling to it. And if you don't, well, you can honor those who do believe on a day like this. A light news day, but still plenty to comment about. Yesterday, President Obama, with a flourish, with Republicans behind him, signed what is called the Jobs Act. And this starts with a misleading name. JOBS stands for Jumpstart Our Business Startups, and it is an invitation to a new round of graft and thievery that could only have originated from the mythical law firm of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. We have learned nothing from Enron. We have learned nothing from the self-regulation of Wall Street that led to the incredible carnage to our economy and to the entire world back in 2008 and 2009. And Obama, while in his State of the Union message this year, sounded the themes of income and wealth inequality, he's a corporatist. And this is just another shining example of how he serves the money interests in this country. Sure, he's going to run against Mitt Romney and Wall Street, and he will sound populist themes. But if we judge his actions and not just his words, well, the judgment will be pretty critical and pretty sharp. What will this bill do? Well, it will enable startups to avoid filing with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, until they're fairly big. It'll allow companies to raise up to a million dollars a year on the internet. It will exempt emerging growth companies of up to $1 billion a year in revenue. Those are huge companies. Some experts say that the revenue threshold is so high that it would exempt 98% of all initial public offerings. The law eases barriers between investment bankers and research analysts. Yeah, the people who tarted up investments and serve them up to victims. The shitty deals that Goldman Sachs offered to its clients and then took bets against them to protect Goldman Sachs. The threshold for many public offerings has been raised by a factor of 10 from $5 million to $50 million. And while there are a couple of protections in here, and the Securities and Exchange Commission has 6 months, they say they need 18, but they only have 6 months to write the rules to implement this law. It is an invitation to graft and theft on a massive scale. And here's a picture of Obama with Eric Cantor clapping his hands as the president has just completed the signing process. And Eric Cantor will return to a full frontal attack on President Obama tomorrow, if not sooner. And the president seems to imagine that by compromising with Republicans and, yeah, one from column A and none from column B, that is somehow bipartisanship. And it just saddens me. The president didn't have to do this. He could have demanded better protections. He could have sent it back to Congress and said, hey, nice idea, but... And he didn't do that. Over at peterbcollins.com today, we are posting the latest Boiling Frogs podcast, an interview with the incredible Pepe Escobar, the international journalist who writes for Asia Times and tells it like it is. And when you hear his comments about Syria, I hope it will open your mind and open your eyes. Here's a brief excerpt from the conversation Sibel Edmonds and I had recently with Pepe Escobar about Syria.
To start with, there are no good guys in this story at all, at all. If we look at the Bashar al-Assad government as a whole, it is basically a very, very harsh police state. But if we look at the Syrian National Council and the so-called Free Syrian Army, it's a similar bunch of defectors, opportunists, and outright gangsters that we saw in Libya a few months ago. So the narrative, so it's basically bad guys against another bunch of bad guys, right?
So this is a film noir.
It is a film noir, and we don't even have a Robert Mitchum moral character at the center of the plot. You know,
yeah.
There is none.
Yeah.
So the problem is, basically, what does that mean for the country, in fact? What we are watching is the slowly fragmentation and disintegration, and I would say Lebanonization in a 1980s concept of Syria. Soon we're going to have services that won't work anymore. Inflation rate would go down the roof. Basically, normal life as we know it in a relatively stable country slowly disappearing from Syria. And this simmering civil war, we are at a low at the moment, right? But soon we're going to have the Free Syrian Army, or at least some factions within what it's called the Free Syrian Army, more and more weaponized by the U.S. directly or indirectly. It has already been advertised publicly by the Obama administration, and especially by the Saudis. So what we're going to have is a lot of very dangerous Islamists with guns running amok all across Syria, not only close to the Lebanon border, but in Daraa near the Jordanian border, and especially all across the north, near the Turkish border as well. They're doing the back and forth for months now.
You can hear that full interview at peterbcollins.com, and I remind you that April is our month where we're trying to expand our subscriber base and double it. And we have a free gift for people who sign up either for our $50 annual subscription, for a $10 a month or more annual a monthly subscription. And we're going to do a random drawing among people who sign up for a new $5 a month basic subscription at the end of April. And in each case, we're going to award copies signed by the author of a powerful book about the misdeeds of the CIA. It's called A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. It's a great book. It's something you should have and should read. And I'd like you to have one if you can be one of our new subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And if you're already a subscriber, can I ask you to put the squeeze on a friend or a like-minded individual? That's what keeps this whole thing going. And I do appreciate your support. Well, here at Good Friday and Easter time, Pope Benedict XVI has kind of moved on from the kinder, gentler Pope. He is cracking down on wayward Catholics who think for themselves, who question the patriarchal teachings of the Church that subjugate women and that consign priests to a meaningless vow of celibacy, which, of course, is widely abused and leads to the abuse of children of both genders. The 85-year-old Pope, whom many Catholics believe is just an interim Pope, doesn't seem to see it that way. He's cracking down on a group of Austrians who have spoken out, calling for the ordination of women and an end to the celibacy rules because there are so few priests left in Austria. And the target is a group called Caritas Austria, led by the Reverend Helmut Schuller. And the Pope is busy cracking down while he ignores the fires burning in Catholic churches, this is figuratively, around the world. Fires led by the pedophilia scandals and the intentional cover-ups, some of which were orchestrated by this current Pope himself when he was merely Cardinal Ratzinger. It's really ugly, and whatever credibility the Church has been sharply reduced, if not destroyed, by these scandals and by the mismanagement of them. And in Missouri, on Thursday, a judge refused to dismiss charges against a Kansas City diocese and its bishop Bishop Robert Finn and the diocese are charged with failing to report suspected child abuse, which is mandatory under state law. And when similar actions were taken in Ireland, the message from the Vatican was, ignore secular law. We report only to the guy upstairs. Powerful New York Times editorial here on Friday about Florida's gun laws, and they've been brought into sharp relief by the Trayvon Martin scandal. We know about the Stand Your Ground law that was written by the fine folks at ALEC, fueled by corporate America and the Koch brothers. And the Times points out that this year the Republican convention will be held at the end of August in Tampa, Florida. And officials there wanted to ban handguns outside the convention hall. But there is a state law that can impose a $100,000 fine on local governments that try to limit gun rights, such as they are in Florida. Be very interesting to see. I, of course, do not wish violence on any person, even those who I consider to be politically evil. But these are Republican-passed laws. And if anybody gets hurt, at the Republican National Convention because of gun-toting individuals, they will only have themselves to blame. In Connecticut, a law was passed and signed this week that makes it the 17th state to abolish the death penalty. I consider this progress. The only part that's difficult is that it doesn't apply to inmates currently on death row, only on future convictions. But I'll take it. And here in California, a ballot measure has qualified for the November election that would change the death penalty to life without the possibility of parole. And the polls show that that has a very good chance of passing. The state of Michigan has the most extreme law about state-level takeovers of local government that are found, local governments that are found to be insolvent. The little town of Benton Harbor was the laboratory experiment, but everybody knows the governor, Rick Scott. Do I have the right guy? No, I don't. Rick Scott's in Florida. It's Rick somebody in Michigan who passed a draconian law that basically just eviscerates local control. And Detroit has always been the target. And now Detroit is essentially going into a state receivership. And I've spent some time in Detroit, have family there. It's tragic to see what has happened to a once great city. It will never come back to what it was 30, 40 years ago. But I think it's unlikely that some sort of a bean counter dispatched from the governor's office in East Lansing will be able to solve the complex problems in Detroit that have avoided any resolution for so long. And Rachel Maddow, on her program Thursday evening, did a great job of detailing how the Republicans in the legislature in Michigan rammed through these emergency powers a year ago, and they openly violated the state constitution. Because for these laws to have taken immediate effect, as they did, that's the way they were written, required a supermajority, a two-thirds vote in both houses of the legislature. And Maddow showed a clip of one of the hearings, or one of the votes, one of the sessions, I believe in the state Senate, where this bill was passed with the immediacy element added. And it required a head count of the senators to see if there was, in fact, a two-thirds majority. The Republicans have like 67 and they needed something like 74. Those numbers are not precise, but you get the idea. And whoever was, handling the gavel at that time asked for the people to rise who supported it And within 4 seconds, he had deduced that there was a supermajority standing. And that's how majorities rule, when the majorities are in charge of the rules. Internationally, a hunger strike in Bahrain is drawing attention to the plight of activists there who have been brutally repressed over the past year with the help of the United States and Saudi Arabia. And there is an individual, an activist, named Abdulladi Al-Khawaja, who has been on a hunger strike for 58 days. And on Friday, thousands of people took to the streets after prayers to join a protest and support this hunger strike. This is in advance. About 2 weeks from now, there will be a large Formula One race, the Bahrain Grand Prix. And I don't know who the sponsors are. I don't know any of the financial details of this Grand Prix. But the people who stage it and the people who broadcast it and then advertise on the broadcast and profit from it should all step back and say, no, not going to do it in Bahrain this year. Earlier this week, I drew attention to the fact that the United States announced in India a $10 million reward for a Pakistani leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba. His name is Hafiz Saeed. And it's interesting to see what's occurred in the last few days, because Pakistan, a very uncertain ally of the United States, is bristling. This, of course, they believe interferes with their sovereign right to deny that they had anything to do with the attacks on Mumbai, India, when the evidence is pretty clear that Pakistan and even officials in Pakistan had a pretty direct role. Nonetheless, despite those crocodile tears, Mr. Saeed is busy notifying the United States government of his whereabouts, daring them to take him into custody. I don't know if he hopes to collect the reward on himself, but he, for example, on Wednesday appeared in front of a group of reporters at a hotel across the street from military headquarters in Rawalpindi. And then he published his schedule for the rest of the week. That's a real ballsy guy, isn't it? I guess when you have the forces of Lashkar behind you, you can be exceptionally brave. And one more item on Afghanistan, where corruption is the rule. Hamid Karzai has ordered an investigation and a special prosecutor to look into the losses at the Bank of Kabul, alleged to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It says most of the loans were taken by politically connected insiders, including the president's brother. He has several. One died last year. And investigators say that few of those loans were ever meant to be paid back. Cleaning up the mess is estimated to be a minimum of $900 million. And this is another one-day story. There will be no meaningful investigation, and the money won't be recovered, and none of Karzai's cronies will be held accountable, and the United States will still be trapped in a hopeless occupation in the graveyard of empires. Thanks for listening. Share this podcast far and wide. Passover greetings. Happy Easter. I'll talk to you soon.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until